It's 1999, a conference room in San Jose. George Bell, the CEO of Excite, one of the largest internet portals in the world, is sitting across from two Stanford graduate students who want to sell him their search engine. The students are asking for $750,000. Excite has revenue in the hundreds of millions. The price is a rounding error.
Bell says no. And the reason he says no is the most counterintuitive business decision of the entire internet era. He turns down PageRank not because it doesn't work, but because it works too well. Bell's concern, as it's been reported by multiple sources, is that if search returns perfect results instantly, users will leave the Excite portal immediately. They'll find what they want and leave. They won't browse, they won't click on display ads, they won't generate the page views that Excite's advertising model depends on. A better search engine is, from Excite's perspective, a worse business.
George Bell chose to protect his existing business model instead of acquiring the technology that would have made him the most powerful company on the internet. Excite filed for bankruptcy in 2001. Google, as of today, is worth nearly $2
trillion. $750,000. $2 trillion. That's the cost of optimizing for the wrong metric.
Welcome back to Silicon Valley Strategy. I'm Myra D'Amico.
And I'm Travis Carlisle. This is Episode 8. So $750,000 versus $2 trillion. That gap is what happens when you optimize for the wrong metric, when you reject the future because it threatens the present.
I've been thinking about that Excite number all week. $750,000. You couldn't buy a house in Menlo Park for that today. And it would have bought you Google.
It's the kind of number that should keep every CEO awake at night. What are you saying no to right now that could be worth $2 trillion?
And today we're doing Google Part 1, the founding, the algorithmic insight, the business model innovation, and the IPO. We'll save Android, YouTube, and the existential AI question for Part 2.
This is one of those stories where the company is so dominant, so embedded in daily life, that people forget how unlikely the whole thing was. In 1998, there were dozens of search engines: AltaVista, Excite, Lycos, InfoSeek, Hotbot, all 1990s web search portals that have since disappeared. Yahoo, the market was crowded. Nobody was looking for another search engine. VCs turned Google down repeatedly. The idea that search, a feature, not a product, in the prevailing wisdom of the time, could become the foundation of a multi-trillion dollar company was considered, frankly, ridiculous.
And yet, here we are. Before we get into the story, trivia. Listeners, here's the question. Google almost sold to Excite in 1999 for $750,000, as we mentioned in the cold open. But the details of why the deal fell through are even more revealing than the headline. Specifically, what was George Bell's reported objection to PageRank, and what does it tell you about the portal business model?
Great one.
Pause if you want to think about it. The answer? Bell reportedly told Vinod Khosla, the legendary venture capitalist and co-founder of Sun Microsystems, who was trying to broker the deal, that PageRank worked too well. The concern was that highly relevant search results would cause users to leave the Excite portal quickly. The portal model, which Excite, Yahoo, Lycos, and others were all running, depended on keeping users on the site as long as possible, browsing through categories, clicking on display ads, generating page views. Good search was the enemy of good engagement. The longer a user spent searching, the more ads they saw. Instant, accurate results meant fewer page views, fewer ads, less revenue.
This is one of the cleanest examples of the innovator's dilemma in the entire technology industry. The portal incumbents couldn't adopt superior search technology because it was structurally incompatible with their revenue model. Their business was built on inefficiency, on users needing to browse, click, explore. Google's business would be built on efficiency, on users finding exactly what they wanted instantly. The two models are in direct opposition.
And the punchline. Bell was right that good search would destroy the portal model. He was just wrong about what to do about it. Instead of acquiring the technology and finding a new business model, he rejected the technology and tried to preserve the old one. 2 years later, the old model was dead, and the new one was worth billions.
This is why we study corporate history. The same information was available to everyone. The strategic conclusion was not.
Let's set the context. It's 1998. Google is incorporated on September 4th in the garage of Susan Wojcicki's house in Menlo Park. Wojcicki, a Google employee who would later become CEO of YouTube. What does the internet landscape look like?
The internet is organized around portals. Yahoo, Excite, Lycos, AOL, these are the major properties. The mental model is that the internet is a place you go, and the portal is your front door. You start at Yahoo, and from there you navigate to content categories: news, sports, finance, entertainment. The portal curates and organizes the internet for you. Search exists, but it's a feature within the portal, not a destination.
And the portal business model is display advertising, banner ads. You sell impressions, eyeballs looking at rectangular advertisements on the page. The metric is CPM, cost per thousand impressions. And the way you maximize CPM revenue is to maximize page views, which means you want users to stay on your site, click through categories, browse, explore. Everything about the portal model is designed to increase time on site.
The advertising being sold is essentially digital billboards, the same model as a magazine ad or a highway billboard. You're paying for the probability that the right person sees your ad while doing something else. There's no intent signal. A banner ad on Yahoo's homepage reaches millions of people, most of whom have no interest in whatever the ad is selling. The advertiser pays for exposure and hopes that some fraction of that exposure converts.
And there's a deep information theory problem here that nobody in the portal business is thinking about. Claude Shannon, the father of information theory, established in 1948 that the value of a signal is inversely related to its probability. The less expected a message is, the more information it carries. A banner ad shown to a million random people carries almost zero information about any individual user's intent. The signal-to-noise ratio is catastrophically low. The portal model is, from an information theoretic perspective, the worst possible way to match advertisers with customers. It's broadcasting when it should be narrowcasting.
And that's what makes the Google story so analytically rich. Google didn't just build a better search engine, it solved a fundamental information problem. The search query is the signal. When someone types "buy running shoes," they've just transmitted a high information, low noise signal about their intent. The portals were trying to infer intent from behavior. What pages did you browse? How long did you stay? Google had the user literally telling it what they wanted. The information asymmetry between Google's signal and the portal signal is the entire story of why Google won.
And into this world come two Stanford PhD students who've built a search engine that's qualitatively better than everything else available. Not marginally better, qualitatively better. The experience of using Google in 1998, if you've been using AltaVista or Excite, is like the experience of putting on glasses for the first time. You didn't know how blurry the world was until it came into focus.
The other important context is that the dot-com bubble is in full swing. Capital is abundant, the NASDAQ is climbing, but search isn't where the money is going. The money is going to portals, to e-commerce plays, to eyeballs before revenue companies. Search is considered a solved problem, a commodity. The prevailing wisdom is that all search engines are roughly equivalent, and the differentiation is in the portal experience around the search. Nobody thinks search itself is a business.
Which is why Google has trouble raising money. Vinod Khosla at Kleiner Perkins passes. Several other VCs pass. The eventual seed investment comes from Andy Bechtolsheim, co-founder of Sun Microsystems, who writes a check for $100,000 to Google Inc. before the company is even incorporated.
And here's the thing about that check that blows my mind every time I think about it. Bechtolsheim wrote it to Google Inc., a company that didn't legally exist yet. They couldn't cash it for weeks because Larry and Sergey hadn't set up a bank account. The check sat in a drawer, $100,000 made out to a fictional entity sitting in a desk drawer in a rented house in Menlo Park. That's either the most reckless or the most prescient investment in the history of Silicon Valley.
Given the outcome, I'd go with prescient. But think about what Bechtolsheim saw that the VCs missed. He was a hardware engineer, a systems thinker. He didn't evaluate Google as a search company. He evaluated it as a system that solved a problem nobody else was solving. The VCs were looking at the market and saying, search is a commodity. Bechtolsheim was looking at the technology and saying, this is categorically different from everything else.
And that check, written to an entity that didn't exist for a technology the market considered irrelevant, deposited weeks later into an account that didn't exist when the ink dried, that check has returned something on the order of 1,000,000 to 1. Bechtolsheim's $100,000, if held, would be worth north of $100 billion. That's not an investment. That's a rounding error that became a civilization.
And this is coming right after the dot-com bubble we just covered. VCs are funding sock puppets and online pet stores. But they're passing on the technology that'll become the most profitable advertising business in history. The capital allocation failure of the late 90s wasn't just about funding bad companies. It was about not funding the great one.
That's the part that doesn't get enough attention. The bubble was a sin of commission and omission. Larry Page and Sergey Brin meet at a Stanford orientation event in 1995. By multiple accounts, they disagree about almost everything.
Which is fitting, given what happens next.
Page is working on the Stanford Digital Library Project, exploring the mathematical structure of the World Wide Web. His insight, and this is genuinely one of the great intellectual leaps in the history of computer science, is that the link structure of the web is analogous to the citation structure of academic papers. In academia, the importance of a paper is measured not by the paper itself, but by how many other papers cite it. A paper cited by 1,000 other papers is more authoritative than a paper cited by 3. And a citation from a highly cited paper is more valuable than a citation from an obscure one.
Page treated the web as a citation network. That's the key phrase. Not a collection of documents to be keyword matched, but a citation network. A vast directed graph where every hyperlink is a vote of confidence. A web page that's linked to by many other pages is more important than a page with few links. And a link from a highly linked page, say the New York Times homepage, is more valuable than a link from a random personal blog. This is PageRank. It's quite literally named after Larry Page.
I mean, the elegance of this is staggering when you think about it in terms of information theory. The existing search engines, AltaVista, Excite, Lycos, ranked pages primarily by keyword density. If you searched for Stanford University, the engine counted how many times the words Stanford and University appeared on each page and ranked accordingly. That's a low information signal. The words on a page tell you what the page claims to be about. The links to a page tell you what the rest of the internet believes the page is about. One is self-reported, the other is peer-reviewed. PageRank turned the entire web into a peer review system.
And keyword density was trivially easy to game. You could stuff a page with invisible text containing the keywords 1,000 times and rank first. PageRank is fundamentally harder to game because you can't easily create thousands of inbound links from authoritative sites. The authority signal is distributed across the entire web. To manipulate PageRank, you'd need to manipulate the link structure of the internet itself. Which eventually people did. The entire SEO industry exists because of this. But in 1998, PageRank produced search results that were dramatically more relevant than anything else available.
And Page and Brin initially don't think of this as a business. They're graduate students. They publish a paper, The Anatomy of a Large-Scale Hypertextual Web Search Engine, and they try to license the technology. They approach every major portal, Yahoo, Excite, AltaVista, InfoSeek. They're asking for $1 to $2 million for the technology.
Everyone passes. And the reasons they pass are instructive. The portals don't want better search because better search conflicts with their business model. And the search-specific companies like AltaVista don't think search technology matters enough to pay for it. They believe the differentiation is in scale and distribution, not in algorithmic quality. The incumbents' existing models made it structurally impossible for them to recognize the value of what Page and Brin had built. That's counterpositioning operating in reverse. The thing you can't adopt is the thing that kills you.
So Paige and Brynn, somewhat reluctantly, start a company. They take Andy Bechtolsheim's $100,000, set up in Susan Wojcicki's garage, and start building.
And this is where the story takes one of those turns that's so ironic it almost feels scripted. In 2000, Yahoo, the largest internet property in the world, hires Google to power its search results. Yahoo's users type queries into the Yahoo search box, and behind the scenes, Google's algorithm generates the results. Yahoo pays Google for this service.
The thing that's analytically interesting is why this happened. Yahoo saw itself as a media company, not a technology company. Its core competency was content curation, portal design, and advertising sales. Search was a feature, not the product. Outsourcing search to Google was, from Yahoo's perspective, a sensible allocation of resources. Let the specialists handle the technology while Yahoo focused on what it believed was the real business.
But here's where network effects enter the picture. And they enter in a way nobody at Yahoo anticipated. Every query that flowed through the Yahoo-Google partnership generated data, what users clicked, what they ignored, how they refined their searches. That data fed back into Google's algorithm. More queries meant better results. Better results meant more queries. Yahoo was, without realizing it, giving Google the raw material to build the most powerful network effect in the history of information technology. Not a social network effect, where more users attract more users. A data network effect, where more usage makes the product better, which attracts more usage.
And Google used this contract to gain scale, improve its algorithm with Yahoo's query volume, and build brand recognition. Every search on Yahoo was effectively a free advertisement for Google's technology. Users began to notice the powered by Google attribution at the bottom of Yahoo's search results. Some of them went directly to Google. Yahoo was paying Google to build the audience that would eventually make Yahoo irrelevant.
It's the classic case of a company outsourcing what it thinks is a commodity function, and the vendor turning that commodity into a strategic weapon. Yahoo thought search was infrastructure. Google knew search was the product.
In 2004, Yahoo terminates the deal and launches its own search technology. But by then, Google has over 50% of the search market and is accelerating. The horse had left the barn, crossed the county line, and enrolled in a different university.
That metaphor got away from you.
It did. But the point stands. And this is the same pattern we saw with Intel and DRAM in the earlier episodes. Outsourcing a capability you think is commodity, only to discover it was the entire game.
Yahoo outsourced the future to Google and paid Google for the privilege. That might be the most expensive outsourcing decision in corporate history. And every query that flowed through that deal was building Google's cornered resource, a data asset that competitors can't replicate or acquire. Each search generated feedback data. Each click told the algorithm what was relevant. Yahoo was literally training Google's competitive advantage and paying for the privilege.
I want people to sit with that for a second. Yahoo paid Google to become unbeatable. That's not a metaphor. That's literally what happened. Which brings us to the moment where Google goes from being a great search engine to being a money-printing machine. In October 2000, Google launches AdWords, a self-service advertising platform where businesses can bid on keywords and display text ads alongside search results. And here's a detail that gets lost in the retelling. In its initial form, AdWords was a self-serve product anyone could use for $5. $5 to start advertising to the entire internet. No sales call, no account manager, no minimum spend, just a credit card and a keyword. That's how democratized it was.
Wait, $5? That's remarkable, because what that means is that the small business owner in Topeka, who sells running shoes, can compete for the same advertising space as Nike. The auction doesn't care about your brand or your budget. It cares about your relevance. That's a fundamentally different advertising model than anything that existed before. In every prior model, television, print, billboards, even portal display ads, the biggest spender won. In AdWords, the most relevant advertiser could win.
But the initial version was still a straightforward CPM model. Pay per thousand impressions, like every other advertising product on the internet. The revolution comes in February 2002, when Google makes a change that transforms the company and arguably the entire advertising industry. It switches AdWords from CPM to CPC, cost per click, and introduces an auction mechanism. Google would later formalize this with a concept called Quality Score in 2005.
And this is where mechanism design enters the story. I want to be precise about this because the design of the AdWords auction is one of the most elegant examples of mechanism design in the history of markets, right up there with the Vickrey auction and the FCC Spectrum auctions. Here's how it works. An advertiser bids on a keyword, say, buy running shoes. They set a maximum price they're willing to pay per click. But Google doesn't simply show the ad from the highest bidder. Instead, it calculates an effective bid by multiplying the advertiser's bid by a quality score, which is Google's prediction of how likely a user is to click on the ad.
So if advertiser A bids $2 per click but has a low quality score, meaning Google predicts users are unlikely to click, their effective bid might be $1. And if advertiser B bids $1.50 but has a high quality score, their effective bid might be $2. Advertiser B wins the auction despite bidding less.
And here's why this is genius from a mechanism design perspective. In a simple highest bidder auction, you get what economists call the winner's curse problem applied to relevance. The advertiser with the deepest pockets wins, regardless of whether their ad is useful to the user. Over time, users learn that the ads are irrelevant, they stop clicking, advertiser ROI drops, bids drop, revenue drops. A death spiral. Google's quality score solves this by making the auction a two-dimensional competition. You're competing on both willingness to pay and relevance. The mechanism automatically selects for ads that users actually want to see.
And the result is a virtuous cycle designed into the mechanism itself. The quality score incentivizes relevance. If your ad is relevant to the search query, if users actually want to click on it, your effective bid goes up and you pay less per click. If your ad is irrelevant, your effective bid goes down and you pay more. The system automatically rewards advertisers who create relevant ads and penalizes those who don't.
Which means the user experience improves. The ads that appear are more likely to be relevant to what the user is searching for, which means users are more likely to click on ads, which means advertisers get better return on investment, which means they bid more, which means Google earns more revenue. Every participant in the system is better off. The user gets relevant ads, the advertiser gets qualified clicks, Google gets maximum revenue. It's a positive sum mechanism in a world where most advertising is zero sum.
Google didn't just build an advertising platform. It built a market, an actual auction market that automatically optimized for the interests of all three parties, the user, the advertiser, and Google. Better relevance serves everyone. And this is what creates the scale economies that make Google nearly invincible. The more advertisers compete for keywords, the more revenue per query. The more revenue, the more Google invests in search quality. The better search quality, the more users. The more users, the more advertisers. It's a flywheel that turns on intent.
I keep thinking about how different this is from the portal model. In the portal model, advertising is interruption. The ad exists despite the user's intent, not because of it. In the AdWords model, advertising is response. The user is typing, buy running shoes. They're a buyer at the moment of intent. The ad for running shoes isn't an interruption. It's an answer to a question the user was already asking. The portals couldn't switch to this model without admitting that their entire display advertising product was fundamentally less valuable. Adopting intent-based advertising would have required them to cannibalize their own revenue.
And that's why search advertising monetizes at rates that are orders of magnitude higher than display advertising. A user typing buy running shoes is worth dramatically more to a shoe retailer than a user browsing a news article who happens to see a shoe banner ad. The intent signal is the most valuable signal in advertising, and Google has a near monopoly on it.
The mechanism is the moat.
Four words. That might be the most concise summary of competitive advantage I've ever heard.
I'm going to put that on a t-shirt. Google goes public on August 19, 2004, in one of the most unusual IPOs in history. They use a Dutch auction, where the price starts high and decreases until buyers accept, designed to let the market set the price rather than investment bankers, an attempt to democratize the offering by letting investors bid for shares rather than letting investment banks allocate shares to their preferred clients. The share's price at $85, the company is valued at $23 billion.
Larry and Sergey issue a letter to investors that includes the phrase, "Don't be evil," and warns that Google won't provide quarterly earnings guidance, won't manage to Wall Street expectations, and will make long-term investments that may reduce short-term profitability. It's in tone and substance a direct echo of Jeff Bezos's 1997 Amazon shareholder letter. It says, "We're playing a different game than you think we are."
And the dual-class share structure: Class A shares with one vote each for public investors, Class B shares with 10 votes each held by Larry, Sergey, and Eric Schmidt, who had been brought in as CEO in 2001 to provide experienced management, ensures that the founders retain voting control regardless of their economic ownership. This is the model that Facebook, Snap, and dozens of other tech companies later adopt. Google didn't invent dual-class shares, but it made them acceptable for tech IPOs.
By the time of the IPO, Google has already established the data flywheel that'll become its primary competitive moat. Each search query generates data: what users clicked, what they didn't click, how long they spent on the result, whether they refined the query. This data is fed back into the algorithm to improve future results. More searches mean better results, mean more searches mean more data, mean better results. The flywheel compounds with every query.
And this is the cornered resource that makes Google structurally unassailable. A competitor launching a search engine starts with zero query data. Google has processed trillions of queries. The gap isn't just volume, it's 20 years of compounding improvement that can't be fast-tracked. You can't buy this data, you can't license it, you can't reverse engineer it, you can only build it by processing queries at Google scale for Google length of time. It's a cornered resource created by the network effect of data, defended by the scale economies of infrastructure, and monetized by the mechanism design of the auction. Four simultaneous powers, each reinforcing the others.
Even Microsoft, with essentially unlimited capital, has struggled to make Bing competitive despite investing billions annually for over a decade. Microsoft threw everything at this problem: the best engineers money could hire, integration with the world's dominant desktop operating system, billions in marketing spend, and Bing's market share is still in the single digits. That tells you the moat isn't about money or talent or distribution. It's about the compounding data advantage that only the market leader can accumulate. Every day that passes, Google gets better faster than Bing does because Google has more data. The gap doesn't narrow, it widens.
And by 2010, Google has over 90% global search market share. 90%. In information retrieval, the single most important function on the internet, one company handles 9 out of every 10 queries. That's not dominance. That's near monopoly.
The mechanism is the moat. The data is the moat. The auction is the moat. Four moats that feed each other. The compounding is multiplicative, not additive.
But here's where the Google story gets a twist that listeners of this course should recognize immediately. Because there's a different kind of cornered resource at Google. One that doesn't compound automatically. One that can walk out the door. And it did.
In 2017, 8 Google employees co-authored a paper called "Attention is All You Need." That paper introduced the transformer architecture, the technical foundation underneath every major AI system that exists today. GPT, Claude, Gemini, Llama, every single one. If you've used ChatGPT, if you've talked to an AI assistant, if you've seen AI-generated images or code, all of it traces back to this one paper written by 8 people at Google.
Google invented the foundational technology of the AI era. Full stop. Not contributed to, not influenced, invented. The transformer architecture is to modern AI what the transistor was to modern computing. And Google had the people who built it.
Had. Past tense. Because several of the key authors left. Ilya Sutskever went to OpenAI, where he became chief scientist and helped build GPT-3 and GPT-4, the models that launched the entire generative AI industry. Noam Shazir left to found Character AI, which Google later reacquired for $2.7 billion. $2.7 billion to buy back one of its own researchers. Other authors scattered across the AI landscape, founding companies, joining competitors, starting labs.
Does this pattern sound familiar? Because it should. Episode 1. Fairchild Semiconductor. The traitorous eight built the foundational technology for the semiconductor industry, and then they left. They founded Intel, AMD, and dozens of other companies. Fairchild invented the industry and lost the people who understood it best. The cornered resource had legs and it walked.
That's exactly right. And the parallel is almost eerie. Google is Fairchild. The Transformer paper is the planar process. The authors who left are the traitorous eight. Google invented the technology that powers the entire AI revolution, and then lost several of the people who understood it most deeply to competitors. The data flywheel is a cornered resource that stays. The talent is a cornered resource that leaves. And if you're not paying attention to which cornered resources have legs, you will learn the lesson the way Fairchild learned it.
Think about the absurdity. Eight Google employees write the single most important AI paper in history. Within a few years, Sutskever is at OpenAI building GPT-4. Shazier founds Charactered AI, and Google has to reacquire him for $2.7 billion. Google invented Transformers and then had to buy back the people who understood them.
That's the Fairchild pattern. Your cornered resource has legs. Google kept the data flywheel, kept the TPUs, kept the infrastructure. But the human capital that knew how to push the frontier, it walked out the door and built the competition.
The Fairchild pattern, 50 years later, at the most valuable company in the world, your cornered resource has legs. Never forget that.
And Google's data moat is still extraordinary. That hasn't changed. But the AI era was ignited by Google's own people, working at Google, using Google's infrastructure. And the company that should have had a 5-year head start in the AI race instead found itself scrambling to catch up to products built by its own former employees. That's not a failure of technology. That's a failure of talent retention. And it might be the most expensive talent retention failure since Fairchild.
And if mechanism design and data flywheels fascinate you, the online course at svstrategy.x, YZ goes deeper on every framework we discuss. It has interactive simulations, AI roleplay, where you make decisions as actual executives, and a full 7 Powers analysis toolkit. That's SV, short for Silicon Valley, strategy.xyz.
SVstrategy.exy is worth your time.
Let's land this. Key takeaways from Google Part 1. And I want to make the frameworks explicit here, because there are 4 strategic concepts from this story that apply far beyond search.
Number 1, and this is the framework I think matters most for anyone building a business, information theory applied to advertising. The portals optimized for time on site. More time meant more page views, more ad impressions, more revenue. This created a perverse incentive, make things harder to find, not easier. Google optimized for the opposite, make things as easy to find as possible. Get the user to their answer in one click. This seems like it should generate less revenue, but it generates more, because the advertising model is intent-based. The unit of value in advertising isn't the impression, it's the intent signal. A user who's typed a purchase intent query is worth vastly more than a user who's idly browsing. Shannon's information theory tells you why. The search query is a high information signal in a world of low information noise. Google captured the signal. The portals were selling the noise.
Number 2, the data flywheel as the most durable competitive advantage in information businesses. This is distinct from network effects, although people often conflate them. A network effect means the product becomes more valuable as more users adopt it. A data flywheel means the product becomes better as it processes more data, and a better product attracts more users, which generates more data. The distinction matters because network effects can plateau. But data flywheels don't plateau in the same way. Each additional query provides marginally less improvement, but the improvement never reaches zero. The flywheel keeps spinning, and the advantage keeps compounding, indefinitely. A competitor trying to match Google isn't just trying to match Google today. They're trying to match a target that's moving away from them.
Number 3, mechanism design as competitive advantage. The Quality Score Auction is a framework about how to design a multi-sided marketplace that optimizes for all participants simultaneously. In a simple highest bidder auction, the winning ad would often be irrelevant. The advertiser with the deepest pockets wins regardless of relevance. This degrades user experience, which reduces clicks, which reduces advertiser ROI, which reduces bids, which reduces revenue, a death spiral. By introducing quality score, weighting bids by predicted relevance, Google aligned the incentives. Relevant ads win auctions. Users see relevant results. Advertisers get clicks from interested users. Google maximizes revenue. Whenever you're building a multi-sided marketplace, the mechanism design, how you structure the matching, pricing, and ranking, determines whether the marketplace creates a virtuous cycle or a vicious one. Google got the mechanism right, and that mechanism has generated hundreds of billions of dollars in value.
And number four, this is the Excite lesson, the George Bell lesson. Don't outsource your competitive advantage, and don't optimize for your current business model at the expense of the future one. Yahoo outsourced search to Google because it believed search was a commodity function. It wasn't. It was the function that determined who controlled the user's relationship with the internet. And Bell was right that better search would destroy the portal model. He was wrong that this was a reason to reject better search. The correct response was to acquire the better technology and build a new model around it, even if that meant cannibalizing the existing business. Because the existing business was going to die anyway. The only question was whether it would be killed by a competitor or replaced by something better from within.
Excite chose to protect the present. Google built the future. The present always loses that fight.
And number five, the Transformer talent exodus. Google had 8 employees write the most important AI paper in history. Several key authors left. The company that invented the technology that powers every major AI system on Earth found itself racing to catch up to products built by its own former employees. This is the Fairchild pattern from episode 1, operating at Google scale. Your data flywheel is a cornered resource that compounds and stays. Your talent is a cornered resource that can walk out the door and start a competitor. The strategic question isn't just what cornered resources do you have. It's which of those resources have legs.
And that Fairchild parallel deserves emphasis. Fairchild invented the semiconductor industry and lost the people who built it. Google invented the AI era and lost several of the people who understood it best. In both cases, the parent organization had every structural advantage: the capital, the infrastructure, the data, the brand. And in both cases, the people who left created more value outside than the parent captured inside. The pattern is relentless. Protect the present, lose the future, every time.
And that's the through line of this entire course so far. Fairchild protected the parent company structure and lost its best people. The record labels protected album sales and lost the distribution channel. The carriers protected the customer interface and became pipes. Excite protected the portal model and went bankrupt. The pattern is relentless. Protect the present, lose the future, every time.
Through lines, through line one. The search index is the substrate of the internet economy. And through line four, sequenced leverage. Search to ads to Gmail to Maps. Each product made the others more valuable, and the terms were locked in before competitors understood the game. Before we go, if you want to understand data flywheels and the Google model at a deeper level, the online course at svstrategy.exyz has a simulation where you're building a search company and deciding whether to monetize through ads, subscriptions, or licensing. You make the calls before seeing what Google actually did. That's svstrategy.xyz.
svstrategy.xyz. Next time, Google Part 2, Android, YouTube, the failed social attempts, and the question that should keep Sundar Pichai up at night: what happens when AI makes the search box obsolete?
The Innovator's Dilemma visits its most famous student.